Rita Dove, the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet and former poet laureate of the United States, has selected what she considers the most significant poetry of the last 100 years, and it's being published as the Penguin Anthology of 20th Century American Poetry. I'm very pleased that it's brought her back to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
How did this come about? You served as the Special Bicentennial Consultant in Poetry at the Library of Congress. Were you thinking about putting together a collection like this at that time?
No, I wasn't. I had absolutely no intention of putting together an anthology and was perfectly content to read other people's selections. But when Elder Roeder at Penguin Classics approached me and said, we'd love you to be the editor, the sole editor of an anthology that represents the 20th century. This was about 4 years ago. And I thought to myself, well, the 20th century is actually under wraps now. I mean, it's tied up and gone, and now might be the time to really look back on those 100 years.
Well, certain poems get published again and again in all these collections. I assume that one of your goals here was to break through and even if many of these poets are represented in other collections, to give us different poems by them.
That was part of my intention. My main intention, of course, was to choose poems which were great poems, but also great poems that somehow gave you a sense of the world in which these poets lived. And so we all know 100 poems or so by Robert Frost, but why not choose a few that are not the ones that we always use? And so sometimes I mixed it up like that. But always with the intention that the poem was really good. I was trying to think of what makes an impact, what made an impact at the time that it was written, not only on the poets around who also might have gotten, or the younger poets coming up at that time who might have gotten a nudge one way or the other, but just really captured the sensibility of that time at the moment. So there are all those considerations.
Well, when Penguin asked you to put this together, did they also want you to create a more diverse selection than we've seen in most of the previous collections?
I was given no guidelines, which was kind of wonderful and terrifying. In other words, no one said to me, we really hope that you'll do this. But I discovered, it was so interesting, as I began to consider what mattered and what I thought mattered. We start off in the 1900s and they're mostly men and mostly white men, and then it begins to diversify itself, the selection. And so I discovered that as I got closer and closer to the end of the 20th century, that there was an incredible array of voices that were coming in that were diverse.
This book doesn't have a cover, a regular jacket. It's all of the stuff is printed on the hardcover jacket.
Right.
And on the back, there's a list of poets who are included. And every one of these poets, I think, is a great poet. But people will still be surprised to not see certain names here. Did you choose this list?
This list? I helped choose the list. I was asked to choose a list, and I tried to get a list that was first of all, it's a list that I think, as you said, all of these poets are great. I wanted a diverse list. I wanted a list that reflected male and female, and a list that would make people go,
But nobody's going to look at this and say, why is Elizabeth Bishop there, or Gwendolyn Brooks, or Adrienne Rich, or Anne Sexton? These are all great poets.
They are. But you're right. They may ask, well, why isn't
W.H. Auden on that list, even though he's in the book?
He's in the book. But we can't put everybody on the back, you know. That would have been one choice, to put everybody's name on the back. But I thought this was kind of the book, as you say, does not have a cover, and it's really done like an old-fashioned book that you stick in the library and, than an old den. And the idea of having these names embossed on the back is sort of monumental, and so it made sense to choose a few. And then hopefully people will see that ... and many others and open up the book to find out who they are.
You said earlier that poetry changed over the course of the 20th century. At the beginning, it was mostly dominated by males. Do you think that the place of poetry in American culture and education changed over the last 100 years?
It's changed several times in the last 100 years. And, I mean, I do think, and I talk about this in my introduction, I do think the advent of a lot of very different technological advances, including birth control, but I would also say television and social media, all these things helped take poetry out of the ivory tower. I mean, it could not... People could access it a lot easier and write there in their own homes, practically. So that helped to diversify it as well. And I mentioned birth control kind of by the by, but I meant, you know, the fact that women were being freed up, not only through birth control and washing machines and all that. They are being freed up from some of those tasks to be able to write more, too.
And some of these poems actually deal with those kinds of themes. You have people who are writing rather earthy. You choose some of the more earthy poems by some people instead of the kind that we usually assign to the canon. I don't know how
Maybe
else to say
so.
That.
Yeah, okay, that's a very diplomatic way to say it.
There's a poem by you to your daughter that we couldn't read on the air, probably.
No, you couldn't. You probably couldn't. And yet, I included that poem because I realized that when I wrote it and when I published it, the amount of response that I got from that poem, from other, not only women, from men, from, you know, other poets, that it changed. After that, a lot of, and I don't want to appear, you know, kind of immodest, but I do think that a lot of women writers began to write more graphically about sexuality, felt freed from that. I certainly felt freed reading poems by Anne Sexton, for instance, when I was beginning. And so that kind of legacy carries on as well.
And then there's a poem here by Sharon Olds in which she declares that, well, women can write important poetry just as men can.
Yes.
Not that Emily Dickinson didn't write some pretty important poetry in the 19th century.
Of course not. I mean, Emily Dickinson, of course, she wrote, she is the queen mother, and yet she also could write, "This is my letter to the world that never wrote to me," assuming that the world didn't want to hear her. What Sharon is saying is that...
This is a poem called The Language of the Brag.
Yes, The Language of the Brag. And she's saying, we can brag out there with the rest of them.
And she compares women to the female poets to the great poets of the past, Walt Whitman.
Yes, yes, yes. It's a fabulous poem.
Now, some years back, I went with a bunch of listeners on a literary tour of England. And we went to the Lake Country, and there we visited Wordsworth's house. And I was stunned by how many of the people on that tour knew complete poems by Wordsworth. You don't have that anymore.
We don't. And it is our loss. It truly is our loss. People, I mean, I remember being in second grade and being asked to memorize a poem for homework. And it was the only, you know, time that I ever had been asked to do that. To get the language in your body, you know, to be able to hear the poem, it's one of the things that we've lost.
And do you think it's one of the reasons that when we talk about poetry, often the poems that are cited are from the past rather than the 20th century, even though there were so many great poets in the 20th century?
Well, I think it's two things, Leonard. I think that on the one hand, the ones that people were asked to commit to memory, to commit to their heart, to know by heart, stick with you, and therefore they get reproduced in the anthologies. But it's also just a consequence. It's the name of the game. If someone is in an anthology, they tend to stay in there for a while. And one of the things that I was trying to do with this anthology, because I knew I hit the 20th century, was to be equitable in terms of younger and middle era poets and the older poets, which meant, of course, that with the older poets, some of the they aren't represented as heavily as they used to be in an anthology published in, say, 1960.
Yeah, we don't have The Road Not Taken or Chicago and poems like that are in pretty much every anthology
exactly
that's been published before.
Yes, and yet, you know, we do have poems by Robert Frost and we have poems by Carl Sandburg, some different ones. Because, for instance, I think that Sandburg's poem, Cahoots, is one of his sassier poems. And people don't know that aspect of him. And yet at that time, when he was writing, people thought they knew it. So, and it inspired other poems.
My guest is Rita Dove, who has edited the Penguin Anthology of 20th Century American Poetry, published obviously by Penguin. I mentioned earlier that you were the Poet Laureate of the United States, but you also were the Poet Laureate of the Commonwealth of Virginia from 2004 to 2006. Does every state have a Poet Laureate?
I don't know that. Almost, I would venture to say.
I would think that if you left the University of Virginia in Charlottesville to teach in a school in another state, you could become a Poet Laureate of another state as well.
Just the traveling Poet Laureate of states, right? Just keep going.
Do you have special responsibilities as a Poet Laureate?
I can't speak for other states. And all I can say for the Commonwealth of Virginia is that they follow pretty much the same standards as the U.S. Poet Laureate, which was that it was your responsibility to fill the role. So there were no prescribed, duties.
When and how were you introduced to poetry?
I was introduced to poetry through an anthology. It was Lois.
How old were you?
I must have been. I had just learned to read, so I was about, 10, 9. And it was Lewis Untermeyer's Treasury of Best Loved Poems. Mm-hmm. It was on the shelf because, not that my parents were into poetry, my father is a retired chemist, and I come from a family of scientists. But in those days, there were certain books you were supposed to have, and you needed to have an anthology. There was one on the shelf. I pulled it down. I had no idea what that meant. And I fell in love with it.
Did that inspire you to try your hand at writing poetry?
It inspired me. At that moment, yes, because what I did, everything that I read, I tried to write. I remember that. I wrote science fiction stories. There were poems, and I tried that too. It was incredible that so much emotion could be packed into such a small package of language, and I wanted to do that too.
Well, there are some people who just seem to be able to write poetry, and others of us can't. I don't know whether it's because some people are more metaphoric than others. Do you ever think about why it is that your mind works in that way?
I've thought about it a lot. I can't figure it out. But I think the same way that some people are better musicians or radio hosts or anything else. You find your way to communicate, and sometimes it's through language or it's through your body, through dance or something else, but this is mine.
Poetry in the beginning was meant to be spoken out loud. Do you think that poetry is better when it's read aloud?
I wouldn't say better. I would say that some poems achieve another dimension when read out loud. I do believe that the best poems in some way make the reader start to breathe with them. Now, whether that happens when you're reading it silently to yourself or whether you feel it, through a voice it depends on the poem. And I don't think that, that oral sense of poetry is, for me, intrinsic, but I don't think it's necessarily intrinsic for every poet. I mean, I would say that Ezra Pound is very difficult to read aloud, although it is very vocal. See, so it's an interesting thing.
Well, we go from modernist poetry of the early 20th century to something quite different later. Mm-hmm. Modernism just had its moment with people like Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot.
Modernism, it had moments like everything has its moments, but it stayed longer than most. I mean, I think there are so many reactions to modernism that came out of that are actually coming back, so that you have the Black Mountain School, which we've got to break this language apart almost down to its syllables as Creeley did, or scatter it across the page so you can feel the breaths in the pants and the reconsiderations of thought as Olson was trying to do with the projective verse. But that's also a kind of reaction against the way that modernism kind of pronounced upon the world that there were different sensibilities. It was a pronouncement rather than an experience. So then we're coming back, though, to that sense of talking about talking.
Well, you say there were four monoliths, mm-hmm. Frost, Wallace Stevens, William Carlos Williams, Ezra Pound, and they were joined by E. Cummings and T.S. Eliot. Have all poets since then had been building on that?
I'm reluctant to say that because I'm reluctant to say that because in a certain way, I think things have changed even more. But in general, I would say that they are the monoliths against which many American poets have been playing out, you know, and so either trying to extend that or fighting against it. Okay.
Yeah. Well, you say that Wallace Stevens' poems were unlike anyone else's. What did he do that was revolutionary?
He embodied thought. He embodied the mind. He was a poet who found images for the way in which we apprehend reality, and then he stated them as fact. And that had not been done before. There was none of that. He didn't bother to explain. He said there was a jar in Tennessee, and he didn't say this is a metaphor for the jar. You know, but if you get into the poem, you find your reality trying to break apart like an impressionist painting. So he did something that was totally new.
And I remember in school, William Carlos Williams became the favorite of every aspiring poet of my generation. And that's because he also did something that seemed revolutionary.
He did. Well, first of all, I mean, starting from those beginnings, and of course we've all had the red wheelbarrow, you know, we have that somehow embedded in us. But then many people know him only in that aspect, but he really believed that American poetry was had to evolve through American speech. And so he was really concerned with trying to find a way of embodying that, not an iambic pentameter line, but a line that really got American speech. And he came up with that lovely variable foot, which is one of the closest things to jazz, I would almost say, you know, in American poetry that we had, and that was very early. That was revolutionary and changed the way in which we thought of sound and poetry.
You have a number of Native American poets here, although
yes.
Sherman Alexie, Louise Edrick. Do we see a different tradition or in African American poetry or in somebody like Derek Wolcott who comes from the West Indies? Do we see their cultural backgrounds in their poetry, or when poetry becomes international, is it just international?
Oh, you do see their cultural backgrounds, but it is not limiting. It's sort of like another piece of the mosaic, I find. And you see it, like in the case of Derek Wolcott, you see both that British education system that's gone through and a certain Caribbean lilt and you know, a kind of insistence that you hang along with the story, and that's incredible in him. And then on the other hand, you have Sherman Alexie, who is the urban Native American, in a way, who both takes that incredible level chant that you find in other Native Americans there, and the irony of what has happened to him. But that's in the music as well as the poems. And it's not exclusionary. It's simply saying, this is another piece of America, guys. You know,
Rita Dove gives us a new way of looking at American poetry with some of the most famous poets of the 20th century, but not necessarily the poems that you know them by, in her collection that she's edited called The Penguin Anthology of 20th Century American Poetry. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.